synchronized watches, beloved listeners. It was 80 years ago, back in 1940, that Wendell Willkie lost to Franklin D. Roosevelt in his bid to be POTUS. Actually, we mentioned that election in passing recently as an early case of fake news driving policy in relation to America's decision to join the war or not. You might recall me chatting about hacking with Ben Buchanan. And as we watch the current campaign unfolding in the US, it's a stark reminder of how dramatically US politics can change. Now, although Willkie lost to Roosevelt quite substantially in the election, Roosevelt asked him to be an international envoy across the globe because although they were from opposing parties, they shared a commitment to internationalism. Thus, in 1942, in the middle of the war, Willkie set off on a flight around the world to Africa, the Middle East, China, Russia, and Turkey. Now, to tell us a lot about this fascinating man and his remarkable trip, I am delighted to welcome to the bosom of our family Samuel Zipp. Samuel is an associate professor of American Studies and Urban Studies at Brown University and author of the book I'm holding up to the microphone so you can all see it, The Idealist, Wendell Willkie's Wartime Quest to Build One World, published by Harvard University Press. Welcome to the program, Sam, and thanks for writing the book.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We'll get on to Willkie's later adventures, but first I'd like you to give us a bit of background on the bloke, particularly about his really interesting mum.
Yes, well, Willkie was born in Indiana in 1892, and he was the son of two very sort of iconoclastic people, particularly his mother. Both of his parents were from families of German emigres, families that left Germany in the 1840s during all the revolutions there as the modern German nation was forming up and liberals and radicals were forced to leave the country as it became more of an empire, as it coalesced lands around it to itself. And so they came to the United States with a whole wave of German immigrants, and they were quite liberal, and they carried that liberalism with them through into the United States. And Henrietta Trish, who was Willkie's mother, was a child of parents who were quite committed to the liberal causes of the middle of the 19th century. They were anti-slavery. They lived in Kansas for a few years while that state was going over to slavery. Horrified by what they saw, they retreated to Indiana. And Henrietta was a kind of sort of iconoclastic figure of the day. She was one of the first women lawyers in Indiana history. She was said to be the first person in the town that Willkie was born in, Elwood, to take up smoking. That's, I think, probably a myth. But she was by all accounts, a kind of imperious figure who disdained housework and loved to impress her kids with the stories of her days as a traveling preacher. And she really gave her sons and her daughters, there were six kids in the house, a sort of sense that they could have this large, capacious life, a life outside the bounds of the home, the kind of home life she always wished for but couldn't always get, even though she was one of the first lawyers, female lawyers in Indiana.
Now, Dad was also a lawyer after being teacher.
That's right. They both started in education and both then went into the law. And he was kind of the town's sort of well-known crusading lawyer. He was had sort of left-leaning politics. He represented labor. He was a labor lawyer and represented workers. He met Clarence Darrow at one point. They were very committed to various democratic and populist causes in the late 19th century, and also to sort of self-improvement, learning, and he often was said that Willkie's father often woke up his kids by bellowing inspirational quotes up the stairs, often had them staging Shakespeare and taking on debates at the dinner table. And this is basically the sort of small debating society of the Willkie family is where Willkie really learned the kind of issues of the day of the late 19th and early 20th century.
Mm. And you describe him as charismatic from a young age, you know, a lot of personal magnetism.
That's right. He was the sort of person who was always at the center of things, always at the center of attention, but at the same time, always trying to find his own way through things or to find his own principles. So he had this kind of interesting combination of being a principled person, but also a very social person.
I like a quote here of his. The greatest joy in life is to keep one's thoughts uncontrolled by formulas. I won't be dropped into a mould. I want to be a free spirit. If I wasn't one, I would still be sitting on a cracker box in Indiana. So, a career in law, he moves into work with an energy holding company, and this is where he first comes into conflict with FDR. What did they disagree on?
Well, this is during the early years of the New Deal, the first New Deal in 1934 and 35, and Roosevelt has decreed that he is going to he creates the Tennessee Valley Authority, which is a government project to bring cheaper power to rural parts of the United States where there had been where there was almost no electricity. And this, of course, puts the government in conflict and in competition with local power companies, which aren't expanding as quickly as the government wants them to, but which would eventually, if the TVA went through, which it did eventually, would put these companies out of business. And then there was another act that Roosevelt put in place to get rid of the exact financial structure that Wilkie worked for, the holding company, which was a banking structure that held the assets of lots of different power companies, one of the sort of large cartelizations of industries in that era that attracted so much critique from radicals and from New Dealers. And Wilkie sat at the head of one of these, despite the fact that it was in some ways a challenge to many of his politics. So he became the sort of face of the attempt to defend these holding companies from the New Deal regulators who were trying to regulate them, to extend power to rural areas, and to eventually to shut down these companies. So he had this interesting role in that, and it was one that brought him into the public eye as a critic of the New Deal, even though he was a Democrat.
So, Samuel, was this the trigger from him swapping from being a lifelong Democrat to a Republican?
Yeah, it's a little bit strange. I think he felt that that the Democratic Party under Roosevelt had moved away from some of the things that he felt the Democrats should represent—a kind of spirit of individualism, the individual proprietor as the heart of American of the American economy and American culture—and had moved more towards what we would to these days call big government. Roosevelt, of course, claimed quite rightly that what big government was trying to do was protect the rights of individual proprietors and to protect the American capitalist system in the face of the Depression. And Wilkie was not nearly as far to the right as many of his colleagues in the power industry. But as the most sort of charismatic spokesperson for their industry, he came to be the person who claimed his share, the sort of lion's share of the headlines. And this is, I think, where he began to sour on the Democratic Party. And what really happened was that many Republicans began to see him as a likely challenger because of his charisma and because of his sort of willingness to go out front and take up a cudgel against the New Deal in front of the cameras.
I'm talking to Samuel Zip about the idealist Wendell Wilkie. So he's recruited by some Republican internationalists to run against FDR. He's a dark horse in the campaign for the nomination. In fact, his ascendancy is very strange.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's important to note that the faction of the Republican Party that recruits Wilkie is a particular group of folks. They are mostly Northeastern Republicans, some Midwestern Republicans, but mostly well-to-do, mostly liberal Republicans, a kind of oxymoron these days, who are internationalists, as you said. They are not the quote-unquote isolationists or non-interventionists who held the lion's share of power in the party. So what they're looking for is somebody who's anti-New Deal, but who will also be an internationalist. And so these are people like Henry Luce of the Time Life Publishing and other folks like that who are kind of big, mostly well-to-do people, although he does attract a lot of following amongst middle-class Republicans and people across the middle of American politics,
too. He will also down the track attract African Americans.
Yes, absolutely. He comes out very strongly in favor of civil rights platform, things that Roosevelt can't do and sometimes is not willing to do because of the power of the white supremacists of Southern Democrats in his party. So Wilkie is for an anti-lynching bill, which Roosevelt can't support. He's against the poll tax, which restricts African-American voting. And he gets quite a bit of support from African-Americans. This is before the African-American vote has entirely come over to the Democratic Party, where there is still some support amongst liberal Republicans for civil rights. And Wilkie's one of their biggest champions, and his lifelong friendship with, or his friendship after the election up till his death in 1944 with Walter White of the NAACP is a very meaningful friendship for both of them.
Samuel, this program spends a lot of time looking with fascinated horror at your primary system. But I can't begin to understand how Wilkie can skip the primaries and just turn up at the convention and declare himself the candidate.
Right, right. This is really surprising to those of us, all of us really, who are so schooled in the constant attention we have to this election cycle here. And I was sort of surprised by this too, as a historian, I'm more of a cultural historian, not a thorough student of American politics. But in those days, a candidate could really win over delegates by force of their personality, by the force of them arriving at the convention. And the convention was really where the nominee was made, and was made in all the back rooms, the quote unquote smoky back rooms of these kinds of places. So what Wilkie did was to build a following amongst influential brokers in the Republican Party, and then spend a lot of time wooing delegates across the country, even without entering any of the primaries. And so he could come to the convention in Philadelphia in 1940, still as a dark horse, but with someone who was begun to know. And when many of the other candidates couldn't nail down delegates, he emerged as a possible alternative. And then on the sixth ballot of voting at the convention, after a huge groundswell of support from him, from people who had been wooed and won over by his charisma, and by some backroom deals, as we understand it, the details of which are not well known, amongst his operatives, he eventually prevailed. There were these huge chants from the galleries in the balcony of the convention center, "We want Wilkie, we want Wilkie," and he eventually won.
Let's look at that trip of his. Give us a sort of a rundown on the agenda.
Yeah. So the trip was interesting. It was he had been to it's important to know that he had been to England, to Britain in 1941 during the Blitz. Had been over there as a kind of goodwill trip to help help morale over there. And when he came back, he advocated for Roosevelt's Lend-Lease program, sort of just putting a cap on the sense that he was putting himself outside politics and really looking after the good of the nation, or at least that's how many Democrats and others felt. And then over the next couple of years, as he looked for a way to bring his idealism to bear on the war effort, he kept sort of floating ideas about different places he could go. And finally, what happened was that a group of journalists who were in Russia, in the wartime capital of Kubyshev, which was a small city to the east of Moscow, where the Soviet government had retreated, were there. They were bored. Actually, all the real bigwigs, Stalin and et al., were staying in Moscow even as the Nazis advanced. And they were bored. They had nothing to do. And they had seen how much Wilkie had boosted morale when he visited London during the Blitz. And they sent him a telegram saying, "You should just come over here." And he sent back and said, "Well, there's nothing more I'd like to do." He had a great rapport with journalists. And so he proposed to Roosevelt that he make a flying trip at least as far as Moscow. And then eventually they started talking about the possibilities of this trip, and they extended that to China. There was a great debate that they had over going to India. Roosevelt didn't really want him to go to India because as a British colony, it would offend the British too much if he mouthed off too much. And Roosevelt knew that Wilkie was not one to keep his mind to himself. So they eventually decided on this trip that would take him to Africa, to North Africa mostly.
Well, he goes to Egypt, doesn't he?
That's right. He goes to Egypt, where he first encounters it's where he first sort of encounters the landscape of British colonialism and begins to feel ill at ease with the power that the British have. So he starts in Egypt, then he goes to Turkey, which is very fascinating to him because Turkey is independent and this sort of modernizing nation. He's thrilled to see this international scene there, where he thinks that this is the sort of thing that he believes could happen if the Europeans were forced to give up their empires. We could have this unleashing of modernizing impulses across the globe. So he's quite inspired by Turkey. He then goes to Beirut and Jerusalem, where he sees more of the kind of knotty infighting that happens under the sway of the French Empire and the British Empire. And he's there in Jerusalem when it's still Palestine, before Israel is created, of course. And so he's seeing the beginnings, or the sort of early stages of what will unfold there in the next few years as the state of Israel is created. And then on to Baghdad and Tehran and Moscow and to China, where he continues to feel this great sort of nationalist upsurge that's happening and across the, what he calls the East, you know.
And being a highly literate gentleman, he was able to write a book on his trip called One World, which becomes a bestseller.
Yes, that's right. The book sells something like 4 million copies, which is a pretty large amount for that time. And it also has
amount for any time.
Yeah, right, it is, yeah. It's often called the fastest-selling book in American history because it sort of took the nation by storm across the spring of and summer of 1943. So it was sort of a big publishing phenomenon. Someone called it the Uncle Tom's Cabin of the war years, sort of kind of really popular power that it had. Yeah, so it has this, and it also has this kind of, just as Uncle Tom's Cabin did, it had this kind of sentimental power to make Americans feel like they were connected to the rest of the world. And that's what Wilkie was trying to achieve with the book.
And yet, of course, he doesn't want the world to be Americanized. He wants this notion of egalitarian global interdependence. He was a very advanced thinker.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think he was somebody who was thinking beyond most of the political figures, the mainstream political figures of his day. Part of that was the influence that he had from the Black Freedom Movement, many of whom were themselves thinking in these kinds of terms. He's thinking beyond FDR in terms of the equal relations between countries. There is a sort of residue of Americanism with him, though. He's often seen, and he believed himself to be this great sort of democratic American figure, and sometimes that blinded him and some of his audience to the fact that the United States itself was assuming this giant kind of imperial hegemonic role over the world, or would later in the post-war era. And some of the things that he advocated for, places that he hoped for more egalitarian relations with, particularly a place like Iran, would come under unfortunate American influence in the years of the Cold War. And I think some of his ideals would be undone that way.
I think it's a mercy that Wilkie dies in 1944, because think how horrified you'd be by Trump. Not that Trump has ever heard of Wilkie, I guess, but what happens to Wendell?
Well, Wendell Wilkie is in some ways quite a tragic figure because his life is cut so short. He publishes the book, as we said, in 1943. It has this great run. It's so popular. But all across the end of 1943 and into 1944, there's a sort of gathering undercurrent of nationalism, the very kind of nationalism that he opposed, as the war is grinding on and as Americans are sort of becoming more and more intent in a grim sort of way of just winning the war and getting home. And many of the people who had sympathized with his kind of internationalism, his interdependent internationalism, sort of begin to turn against him, right? There's already the right wing of the Republican Party who are once called themselves isolationists and now just think of themselves as nationalists who are wanting the United States to protect its own interests as they look towards the post-war world. And then there are liberals who will become Cold War liberals who are also assembling around a very kind of slightly less nationalistic, but still pretty hardline position of protecting American interests, particularly vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. You start to see the beginnings of a kind of Cold War face-off happening here. And Wilkie is still trying to press for his ideas, and he goes into the 1944 primaries for the 44 presidential election, and he gets nowhere. He does far worse.
His moment has passed.
And his moment has in many ways passed. And he continues to stump for these ideals, and he works hard to try to make the emerging United Nations as democratic as possible, to try to give the smaller nations and the nations that are still colonized a chance to use the UN to decolonize. Some of his ideas are adopted, but most are not, right? The shape of the UN with its Security Council run by the great powers, which is essentially Roosevelt's idea, is not what Wilkie wanted. He asks for a more democratic shape for it. But even before all this can happen, the first conferences are held around the UN at Dumbarton Oaks in October of 1944 in Washington, D.C. And the day before they go into that, Wilkie dies into that conference. And he actually had been in the hospital for about a month or so. But nobody knew that. It was kept sort of secret that he had had a series of heart attacks, had to go into the hospital, and was said to be recuperating from a stomach ailment. But this was really a result of his ill health. He was somebody who drank too much and smoked too much and never got any exercise and really was courting disaster, a real, you know, sort of hedonist, a kind of pleasure seeker. And so he finally had this series of heart attacks, went to the hospital. He got a little bit better, but then he went downhill. And then in October of 44, he had a series of heart attacks and died. And it was a huge surprise to people.
This is a tonic. Thank you for reintroducing the world to Wendell Wilkie. And I've been talking to his biographer, Samuel Zipp. The book is called The Idealist, Wendell Wilkie's Wartime Quest to Build One World. And it's published by Harvard University Press. Thank you, Samuel.
Thank you.